MacCast, Sunday, April 15th, 2012. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the show. I hope you're having a great day. I've had a pretty nice weekend so far, and of course, I've got a bunch of Apple Mac news and tips and tricks and stuff to bring you this week. It's been an interesting week, to say the least. Apple dealing with some of the flashback fallout and other such things, and you'll hear more about that on this episode, of course. But before we get into everything, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show's sponsors, and that's Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. You know, I had an opportunity this weekend to go up to the Southern California Mac Owners Group and talk a little bit about Notebook, and I realized that I've had it for so long, and I use it for some very specific things. In my case, mostly what I use it for is doing a lot of the research for the show, and I use the web clippings feature, which I've told you about, also basic outlining and note-taking and stuff like that, and I also on occasion use it for a few other things, trip planning and stuff like that, but I had an opportunity to kind of go back in and dig into a lot of the features and functionality that I don't use, and what I was reminded of is that it is such a versatile application. You know, Notebook, the name, many people think that means taking notes. Really, what you have to think about it as is a physical replacement or a digital replacement for a physical notebook. Something that you can organize stuff in, you can bring in other files and documents, you can kind of keep everything related to a project together. And they have this great these great starter templates. When you launch the application, you can have a little wizard and it'll list out a bunch of different projects and things that you could use it for. So for my demo, I did a mock trip to France, and I was amazed that you can do things like if you have your travel agent and you need to contact them for your trip planning, drag in the contact from address book, and that puts it right in Circus Pony's notebook. You get a little sticker in the margin, and clicking on that gives you all direct access to all of the information without having to go back to the address book. So you can call your agent, and then when you get your travel plan set and they send you that email, guess what? You can drag in your itinerary. You can drag in your hotel confirmation as a PDF. You can drag in your flight confirmations as a PDF and put that right into your notebook and keep it all together. And then you can go to another section and start building out a packing list along with checkboxes and check marks. And you can set to-do dates and have reminders sent. And you can even put in audio comments. And it's just unbelievable how much is really in there when you really start digging. And I think it's an application that many Mac owners can benefit from. So you should go check it out. Head over to circusponies.com. They also have free trials, so you can test it out before you make a decision. But I have a feeling you're really going to like it and enjoy it. And a big thank you to Circus Ponies for their support of the MacCast. So this week continued to be a lot about Apple and Mac owners' efforts to try and help eliminate and expunge this latest variant of the flashback malware. I told you about that on the last episode of the MacCast. There was a new version of what used to be a Trojan. It was an application or a piece of malware that would pop up in its original implementation as a flash installer, and then when you would run it on your Mac, your machine would get infected and you'd become part of this Mac bot network that was being built out. And then this latest variant kind of took it from being a pure Trojan to just kind of being malware, because it used a Java exploit and it could install itself without any interaction from the user. But you still had to visit a website that was infected or had the exploit on it, had the Java code on it to get in, you know, to get it on your system. So I guess delivery-wise, it's still in some ways behaving like a Trojan. But regardless, Apple was working really hard this week to try and get it off of people's systems. They released two additional Java updates, Java for OS 10 2012.003 and Java for Mac OS 10.6 update 8, and they not only patched the operating system but also removed the Trojan if you're infected and disable Java and Safari on Lion. If your machine has been infected and you run these updates, the flashback malware variant will be found, it will be removed, and it will alert you to the fact that it did that. If you don't see that message, you can assume that your machine was not infected, but you now have the protections in place. On Lion, also, as I was saying, it immediately disables the Java in your browser plugin and also the Java web start, which is what would automatically sort of fire up Java when you visit a web page that has a applet running on it. And while it does disable it in Safari, that also means it's disabling it for any applications that use a Safari-based browser, or I guess like probably the WebKit core of Mac OS X for like an embedded browser or something like that. So you're going to be protected in some other areas. Also, if you do need Java or you use Java and you need to reactivate it, you have to use the Java Preferences program, which you'll find in your Applications Utilities folder. And even if you go in and re-enable it, you need to be aware that now OS X, if you do not use Java in your browser for 35 days, Lion will go back in and re-disable the Java options. So if you come back and you're maybe going to a web tool that's using Java, say, I see it most commonly with like FTP uploaders. If you have a hosting provider, if you have your website hosted someplace and they offer an in-browser FTP client, that's often written in Java. So you'll have to go back into that Java Preferences program and re-enable Java to get that to work. And I think it disables everything, not only just in the browser, but also just Java on your system. So if you're using a tool like CrashPlan, like I do, you need to make sure that your Java is still on so that CrashPlan will continue to run. But as long as that Java application is in use, you're not going to fall victim to it auto-disabling it. When you're actively using Java, you're not going to get hit by this 35-day limit. So just be aware of that. And certainly the awareness and the removal tools seem to be making a significant impact, because this week, I believe Norton came out around the middle of the week and had done a study. The original estimates were that roughly 600,000 Macs had fallen victim to this latest exploit. Norton reduced that number by half this week. So infections are definitely going down quickly, and I think Apple pushing out these updates is a big part of it. Now, we can get into the debate on whether they should have done this sooner. I personally feel that they should have, but it is being dealt with. And if you haven't run your software update, make sure that you grab these. They also released a tool. Because Mac OS X Lion does not have Java installed by default, you may still have run across the exploit. It might just be sitting there doing nothing on your system. If you want to also remove it, they did release a standalone removal tool for Lion for those of you who don't have Java installed. So I think you can get that through Apple's support website at apple.com/support. A radio interview with French designer Philip Stark caused some excitement this week. He was giving a radio interview, and based on some translations, it came out that he said he was working on a revolutionary new project with Apple. Stark said the project was going to be unveiled within the next 8 months, and that immediately began the rumor sites and blogs sort of speculating on what he might be designing. You know, could it be the design for the new ITV iPanel Apple branded television? Could it be the next generation iPhone, the iPhone 5? Stark has done designs for technology companies in the past. I think he's done some work for LaCie, the hard drive company. Sebastian Page over at the iDownload blog said his sources claim it's not actually a product at all. It's actually he's working on some designs for an Apple retail store. I would assume a retail store probably coming to some city in France. But then Cult of Max pointed out that there's a portion in the Steve Jobs biography that says he was working with a Dutch shipmaker designing a 40-foot yacht, and that Stark was reportedly working on designs for that because Jobs wasn't happy with any of the designs that the shipmaker was coming up with. So now a lot of people are speculating, believing this is a new yacht that Stark is continuing to work with Steve Jobs' widow, and they're still going to be pushing forth this new ship design. So might not be an Apple product at all, although the radio interview said it was a project for Apple. So that could be a little confusing. Maybe something happened in the translation. I don't know. My guess would be that if it is specifically for Apple and it's not the boat, the ship, I guess I shouldn't call a yacht a boat, the ship, then my speculation would be that Sebastian Page over at the iDownload blog is correct, that he's maybe working on a design for a new retail store in France, which would be really cool to see. And interesting, you know, Apple is always loved great design, and I guess Stark and Jobs were somewhat friends, and so it could make sense that he'd be doing some sort of work for Apple. Some bad news this week for those of you in Germany. It looks like you're not going to be able to get push email on iCloud or Mobile Me anytime soon. A German judge extended an injunction against Apple preventing them from rolling out push email services to iCloud and Mobile Me. The injunction is actually part of a patent dispute with Motorola that's been ongoing. They claim that the services violate a patent they hold relating to syncing of messages to pagers. So that kind of gives you an idea about how far back that that patent goes. Apple, of course, has been appealing this decision, but it's obviously having no luck. The decision was upheld, and it was ruled that Apple was actually liable for damages, although there was no amount given. Hopefully, at this point, Apple will just go back to the table with Motorola and reach some sort of licensing deal agreement and just pay them some money, and then you can get your push-based email in Germany. I can't imagine not having that, so this has to be a frustrating one. There's actually two patents in dispute, I guess, and luckily this ruling also served to separate the two claims. I guess Motorola had been trying to keep them together, and they're going to now be tried and ruled on separately. The second one is actually the bigger one for Apple to be concerned about, I think, because it could block the sale of 3G devices in Germany. So that would be bad news for Apple and for German consumers, I would imagine, which I think is why the injunction hasn't happened yet. But what's going on is that Motorola is claiming to have some patents related to 3G technology. Apple is arguing that since Qualcomm already has a licensing deal in place with Motorola, that they should be covered by the fair, reasonable, and non-discriminatory terms. That's the FRAND terms, if you've heard that terminology before. It says basically, you know, we use Qualcomm chips. Qualcomm has an agreement with Motorola for the licensing of that, and therefore, by proxy, Apple would have licensing for that technology. So even if Motorola is successful in getting a ban on Apple's sales of 3G equipped devices in the region, they may run into further trouble with the European Commission, because that commission has begun a formal investigation to see if Motorola is actually using their FRAND encumbered 3G wireless patents to try and stifle competition in the region. So Motorola may have bigger fish to deal with if they even if they get an injunction against Apple. So we'll have to stay tuned and see what's going on there. If you're in Germany and you have some insight into this or just opinion, love to hear from you. Shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com, or even better yet, send off an audio comment. A couple people got a message this week when they were accessing their iTunes accounts with their Apple IDs that makes it look like Apple's trying to improve account security. I actually didn't see this message when I logged in, but some iOS users have noticed a new security prompt that began popping up. It said security info required, and then asked users to select from a number of security questions and provide personal answers. They also asked for a backup email address in case the primary address associated with the Apple ID was somehow compromised. At first, and I think rightfully so, a lot of people thought that maybe this was some sort of scam, some sort of phishing scam, but Apple representatives did confirm that it's part of their ongoing strategy to help improve and bolster iTunes and Apple ID account security. So if you do see this pop up, it is legitimate. I don't know why only some users are seeing it. We do know that Apple has had some issues in the past, and there have been reports of iTunes accounts getting compromised, and especially people clearing out prepaid accounts. And I think most of those attacks were happening from China, where they'd get access to your account, find out that there's prepaid amounts in there, and then turn around and sell access to those accounts on eBay or something like that. And then someone would use your account to make all of their purchases and get apps and music and movies and stuff like that. So definitely a good strategy is to go in and just review your account, review your purchases. You know, you can go in there and look at your account history through iTunes, and that's probably a good policy to do that every once in a while and just make sure that all of the charges and things that you see in there are ones that you are making. And while we're on the subject of iTunes, 9to5 Mac reported this week that they have some information on Apple's planned changes for the next generation of iTunes. They say iTunes 11 is going to be mostly focused on under-the-hood style changes, things like improving performance, which I think a lot of us welcome. You know, iTunes has gotten a little bit large and bloated over the years and tends to be a little bit of a performance hog, so anything Apple can do to improve the experience on that end is going to be great. They also said that there's going to be more centralized iCloud integration. There'll be a panel in the iTunes preferences to control things like iTunes Match, iTunes in the Cloud, and your iCloud iOS backups and more. So I don't remember the piece giving any kind of date on when they think iTunes 11 will be released. I would suspect, though, that we'll see it around the time Apple does an update to the iPhone and iOS, which most of us believe will be in the fall, probably around the October timeframe. When Apple launched the new iPad, as many of us thought they would, they did reduce the price of the iPad 2, the 16-gigabyte model, and are continuing to sell it. Most of us believed that it was just the same iPad 2 that they've been selling all along. Well, it turns out this week that AnandTech is reporting that not all iPad 2s are created equal. The new ones actually have a new version of the A5 processor. The new model is labeled 2,4, for those of you who care about that sort of thing, but it does have an A5 chip that is built upon the new 32-nanometer process. So the new silicon itself doesn't really seem to make a difference in terms of the raw CPU performance, but it could be a little bit more energy efficient because of that new manufacturing process, so it could get a little bit better battery life. Poking around inside Apple's third-generation Apple TV unit also proved to reveal some interesting stuff. Turns out there's actually a dual-core A5 in there, despite the fact that Apple says it's a single-core CPU. Don't get too excited, though, if you have one of the new units, because it's very likely what's going on is Apple is reusing some of the iPad 2 parts, maybe the A5 processors that have bad cores, and they're simply disabling that bad half to make it a single core. That's pretty common in the CPU industry to kind of reuse silicone like that. And the A5 and the Apple TV is, again, that 32-nanometer version of the A5. So it's probably the new iPad 2 processors that they're then repurposing for the new Apple TV. And the one big difference there is that the die, the actual CPU, is also about 41% smaller. So there is a significant difference in the physical size of the processor from the old one to the new one. Apple is going to be delivering their second quarter 2012 results call on April 24th, and often right before that, we start hearing from analysts about how they think Apple's been doing. This week, we heard that Apple is now number 3 in U.S. PC shipments. This is according to Gartner. They released quarterly shipment estimates for the PC market for the first quarter, Q1 of 2012. They calculate that Apple shipped about 1.6 million Macs in Q1 of 2012, and they say that's about a 3.8% increase from the same quarter in 2011. HP, by contrast, also increased their shipments 6.6% year over year, which is better than Apple did, but much less than the PC industry as a whole, which actually declined about 3.5%. Now, it's important to note that Gartner's numbers do include mini notebooks, but do not include tablets. So when you throw in iPads, Apple's numbers get much larger, but a lot of the analysts and reports aren't considering a tablet or an iPad to be a PC. That's obviously up for debate. Gene Munster over at Piper Jaffray is throwing up his iPad and iPhone predictions ahead of Apple's results call. He predicts that Apple will announce sales of about 33 million iPhones and about 12 million iPads. His numbers are a little bit ahead of Wall Street's estimates. Munster also maintains that Apple's shares will eventually hit $1,000 per share, he's saying, by 2014. And on the Mac side, he's predicting that Apple will sell about 4.3 million Macs for the quarter. So I think by most accounts, everybody is expecting Apple to have another really big, if not record, quarter. The big numbers and predictions aren't too surprising, though, when you start seeing reports like this. Despite being out for about 6 months, ChangeWave did a survey recently, and they said that 56% of future smartphone buyers say they plan on purchasing an iPhone. That's actually up about 2% from a poll taken in December. So iPhone still a hot item and many people wanting to get that as their smartphone of choice. And I think if they did a similar survey around iPads, those numbers would be even higher. Apple got into a little bit of hot water with the Department of Justice this week, and that's probably not a place they want to be in. If they would ask Microsoft, I think they'd give them some good advice in that area. But the DOJ filed an antitrust lawsuit against Apple and some publishers this week. They claim that Apple colluded with the publishers to artificially raise the prices of ebooks by forcing the adoption of an agency style of pricing. Under an agency model, publishers control the pricing of ebooks and not the reseller. Apple also has another issue in the fact that to sell books on the iBook store, Apple employs what many call a favored nations clause. That says that publishers cannot sell ebooks on other stores for lower prices than what they do on the iBook store. This was actually a practice, I think, that Apple started when they started selling newspapers and magazines with in-app purchases. They gave those publishers the ability to sell a subscription through in-app purchase, but did have that clause that said you can't sell that subscription elsewhere for less money, and they've continued that with the iBooks. All of this was said to be done to break Amazon's $9.99 pricing that they had set on many of their ebooks, and also to help raise revenues for publishers. Apple did, after the lawsuit was announced, release a statement, something they typically don't do, and, of course, denied the allegations. They said, quote, "The DOJ's accusation of collusion against Apple is simply not true. The launch of the iBook store in 2010 fostered innovation and competition, breaking Amazon's monopolistic grip on the publishing industry." Amazon had a deal in place where it would actually buy titles at a percentage of the cover price, and then they could resell them at whatever price they wanted. They would often do that at a loss, which makes it very hard for someone like Apple to compete with. Also reduces the amount of revenue that a publisher can get for a specific title. The DOJ also did name a couple other publishers, Simon & Schuster, HarperCollins, Penguin, and Hachette, in the suit. Hachette, HarperCollins, and Simon & Schuster immediately announced that they had reached a settlement with the Department of Justice, though, allowing them to escape the pending litigation. The details of their agreement was not disclosed, but the result is that if Amazon wanted to, they could return to the wholesale pricing model with those publishers' titles. So good news for Amazon on that front. So when all is said and done here, I think what you actually have is you have this sort of fight between consumers and resellers and publishers, and in the end, I think, as always happens, it's usually the consumer that ends up losing. But what's going on is Amazon's model, I think, is really great for consumers in terms of you can get sort of the best pricing, but then Amazon's selling books at a loss, I would presume, so that they can continue to sell their ebook readers and make money on that side of things. Makes it very hard for Apple to compete. It makes it hard for the publishers, or the publishers say it makes it hard for them to make a profit. I don't know if I really buy that side of the argument. But I think also part of this problem is that whole favored nations thing that Apple has. I don't see any reason why a publisher shouldn't be able to go to Amazon, work out a deal, and Amazon set pricing based on their deal, not based on some sort of restriction that Apple has imposed on those publishers. So that's where it gets a little bit dicey, and I think where the Department of Justice may have a little more interest in poking into. But, you know, I don't like to get into the politics of all of this stuff, and it gets really political really quick when you start talking about it. In the end, though, I think the irony is that Apple is going to make out either way, because I still believe that their intent is to cut the publishers out of the model completely and work directly with the authors to get their content out there and published, much in the same way that they do with apps today. You know, you go straight to the app developer sells straight to the consumer, and Apple takes their 30% cut. I think they want to get to that same point with the producers of not only books, but also TV shows and movies and all that sort of thing. I think that's the future. And no matter what, Apple's going to continue to take and get their standard 30% cut, which helps them run the whole program. And then, of course, their devices are going to be the things that we're going to be watching and consuming all this content on. So Apple makes out in the end. They probably want to figure out a way to settle with the Department of Justice rather than going through some long, drawn-out lawsuit that costs a lot of money. This stuff takes a really long time to fight and costs companies a lot. Apple does have a big war chest, but I don't think this is where they want to be spending it. Where I would hope they would be spending it is on R&D and bringing us new products. And that's where I wanted to finish up the news for this week, because I love talking about next generation Macs, something we don't get to talk about so much anymore. But we did get some great rumors this week. Starting off with displays, Sharp announced that they are beginning production on 32-inch high DPI LCD displays. These are massive panels. They're using their IGZO technology. That's iridium gallium zinc oxide technology. They're also going to have panels in a 10-inch and a 7-inch size, presumably for ultra notebooks and tablets. But the 32-inch one is the one that most of us seem to be interested in terms of a potential new Mac. Some are saying that that panel could be for a new iMac. 32-inch iMac sounds pretty large to me. I mean, the 27-inch panel that Apple uses now is pretty big. You can get some neck strain looking at that thing, but it's a nice display. 32 inches, I don't know. It seems to me that it would be more suited for that rumored iPanel, 32-inch Apple TV. The resolution seems right to me. It's 3,840 pixels by 2,160 pixels. That's a perfect 16:9 ratio when you do the math on that. So I don't know if that's where it's going to show up. You know, we have had many reports of Apple looking at next-generation high DPI displays for Macs, and we've seen assets surfacing in versions of OS X that would support high DPI displays. I think most of us, though, feel that the 15-inch or 13-inch MacBook Pro products are probably going to be the first places we see new high DPI displays. We've heard rumors already that Apple's testing those units on campus, and I would imagine that the next generation of those MacBook Pros are going to support high DPI. And those models might be the next ones out of the gate. Earlier in the week, there were reports that we were seeing out-of-stock messages on some third-party sites for specifically the 15-inch MacBook Pros. JNR and Best Buy both reported that they had low supplies and long wait times. I took a look on Apple's online store, however, and they're still showing next-day availability. So there was a little bit of a disconnect, and we went a whole week without seeing a new model release. So it could be soon, but I would imagine it's going to be more in the June timeframe when we see an update of the MacBook Pros. I think longest overdue is the Mac Pro, and we didn't hear anything about that this week, much to the dismay of myself and probably many of you. I think Apple needs to do some sort of revision to the Mac Pro models. Whether it's a redesign, I don't think they have to do that. I think just an update, any kind of update, would be a welcome sight for many of us. And I think the iMacs are getting long in the tooth, too. But again, I just 32-inch iMac, that seems crazy. I don't think we'll see that. I think 27-inch iMacs with some updated processors and graphics cards and things like that, a little more horsepower under the hood would be great. And a lot of that stuff might happen, again, right around that June timeframe, right before we get the summer release of Mountain Lion. And that'll do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to thank another one of our show sponsors, and that's VMware. They make Fusion for Mac. You know, like it or not, occasionally some of us have to run Windows on our Macs, and when we do that, you know, if you're like me, you want the experience to be easy, you want it to be seamless, you don't want to have to reboot or move out of what you're doing in Mac OS X and kind of start all over with a new computer experience. You know, like rebooting up, it's a shocking, jarring experience. And so with VMware Fusion, you can run Windows right alongside your Mac applications. You can even, if you have a bootcamp partition set up, you can even use that existing bootcamp partition with VMware Fusion. So that's part of that making it easy process. The latest version of VMware has over 90 new and improved features. It's optimized for multi-core Macs, so it's fast. It's also ready for Lion. You can even use a lot of the built-in Lion features with your Windows applications, which is really cool. That's the kind of stuff that makes this seamless, right? You can add Windows programs to Launchpad. You can access them from Mission Control. You can use them in native full screen mode. You can even switch between them using the gestures. And VMware Fusion 4 is designed to give you the best possible experience, Windows experience, that you can get on Mac OS X Lion. And the pricing is phenomenal. It's $49.99. And if you use the promo code MACCAST, you get 10% off that. So it's an even better deal. So if you'd like to check it out, if you'd like to get a free trial or make a purchase, you can head over to VMware.com/Mac and check it out, VMware Fusion 4. And a big thank you to VMware for their support of the MacCast. So I want to kick things off this week with a really cool trick. I found this awesome tip over on the Icon Master site, and it was actually pointed out by 9to5 Mac. So I'll have a link to the original article in the show notes at maccast.com. But, you know, it's funny when you come across a tip like this, you realize, wow, I should have thought of that. That would have been so easy to set up. Why didn't I think of that? And so I wanted to share this one with you. What it does is it allows you to access your iCloud photo stream images without having to go into iPhoto or Aperture. So you can access them on your Mac without actually having to go into the native application. You just have them right there in the Finder. And it uses a saved search along with search tokens and the fact that the images are stored in the library folder, in the home folder on your Mac. So the first thing you need to do, of course, is make sure that you're using PhotoStream, that you have it turned on your Mac and on your devices. And when you do that, that's when these images will start showing up in that folder, in your library folder. So once you have it all set up, you go into the Finder and you locate the PhotoStream folder. The easiest way to do that is to option click on the Go menu in the Finder and then select the library. That'll take you to your home folder's library folder. And then when you're in there, you can navigate down, go to the application support folder, the iLife Asset Management folder, and then into Assets. And then when you're in there, you'll see a folder called Sub, S-U-B, B as in boy. And you'll notice that inside the Sub folder, there are a bunch of subfolders with kind of really cryptic names. And then in each one of those folders is one of the photos from your photo stream. So there could be up to 1,000 folders and 1,000 images in that folder. For some reason in mine, I had 1,005, but the photo stream limit is supposed to be 1,000 photos. So obviously, you could just take this folder, you could throw it into your dock and access it, call it a day, and you'd technically have access to your photos, but you'd have a really hard time figuring out which one is which because of the messed up folder names and file names and stuff like that. So this is where Spotlight, a saved search, and some search tokens and stuff can come to the rescue. So what you want to do now is with that subfolder selected, so you have it selected in the Finder and you see all of it. If you're in column view, you'll see all those subfolders with the cryptic names. Keep that selected and then do a standard Finder search. So hit Command F to bring up the search window or just use the little search box up there at the top of the window and type in a search token. And I talked about search tokens in macOS 10 Lion on the show in the past. If you don't remember what that is, what you want to type is the word kind, K-I-N-D, and then a colon. And it's that keyword plus the colon that is the token part of it. There's all kinds of different keywords you can do. In this case, we're going to filter on the kind of file that we're looking for. So you type kind, colon, and in this case, we want image to be the result. So we, after the colon, you type the word image. And then you hit enter and you'll see it'll turn into this special little token. It looks like a little blue kind of pill. And now your results are being filtered to just the images that are in whatever folder you've selected. But if you look up the top in the title bar there, you'll notice that by default, when you start doing a search in the Finder, I believe it has selected this Mac as the place. So it's searching your entire Mac. We want it to search just within that little subfolder. So as long as you had the subfolder selected in the Finder before you started doing your search, up there at the top right next to where it says this Mac, just to the right of it, you should be able to select the subfolder and filter your results just down to that. And once you've done that, in the results window now, you should see just the 1,000 image files that are in that subfolder. And you can adjust the view at this point to whatever view you'd like. I think icon view works pretty well, and then you can bump up the size of the icon so you almost get like a grid of the images that are being returned by that search result. And you could also, if you want, mess around with the search token. Rather than searching just for all images, you could specifically drill it down to just JPEGs, for example, which will just give you the photos. Or if you just want to see screenshots, you know, if you use the feature where you hold down the home and sleep wake button or press the home and sleep wake button at the same time and take a screenshot, when you take a screenshot on iOS, that's a PNG file. So you could filter it to just PNGs. You might want to set one up for photos and one for screenshots, just depending on how you want to do this. But either way, whatever you see in the search results is going to be the thing that you now want to save. So now up at the top, click on the Save button and give it a name. You can call it whatever you like. I called mine PhotoStream. And leave the default location set. It's going to, by default, want to put your save search in your home folder, library, inside the saved searches folder. You can leave that default. And then you can also check on or make sure to keep checked on the add to sidebar option. So now when you hit save, what you'll have is a new saved search. It's a little purple folder with a cog icon on it in your sidebar. And now clicking on that will, in the Finder, show you all of the photos that are in your photo stream. And so you could just leave it in the sidebar and access it from there. I like to have mine in my dock, so I just took it from the sidebar, drug it down, and put the folder into my dock, and then removed it from my sidebar. And now I have a little folder in my dock that anytime I click on it, it jumps right into the Finder and shows me all of the photos that are in my photo stream. So that's really cool. If you ever want to go back and tweak the settings or play around with it a little bit more, you can, when you're viewing your saved search result in the Finder, you can click the little cog in your toolbar, this little cog icon in the toolbar, and select the option that says Show Search Criteria. And then you can go in and you can edit and you can play around with that search criteria and save it back. Again, if you want to go in and just directly access the saved search, it's always stored in your home library saved searches folder by default. So if you didn't change that, you can always go back in and find your saved searches there. And I just thought that was a really cool little trick. And again, I'll have a link to the original article in the show notes at maccast.com if you want to check it out. So I know many of you international Mac geeks know that it's a bit crazy here in the States that we are shackled to our iPhones, I guess I should say, are shackled to our carriers. I mean, they're carrier locked. Getting an unlocked device is either incredibly expensive or it has to be done by doing a jailbreak, at least historically. This week, though, or last week, I told you that AT&T was finally agreeing to unlock customers' iPhones that are off contract. This started on the 8th, and I was excited about this because I have an old iPhone 3GS that's been sitting around, and I wanted to give it a try and share my experience, my AT&T iPhone unlocking experience with you. So the web is sort of full of stories about how this works. So let's start with how the process is supposed to work, and I'll tell you how my experience went. And it was pretty close to this experience. So the first thing that you need to do if you want to unlock your device is you need to go into your iPhone and locate the International Mobile Equipment Identity number, the IMEI number. And you can find this by going into Settings, General, and then About. And you'll find the number there. You're going to need to copy it down and have it ready for later. And then once you've done that, you log into your My AT&T account on the AT&T website. And then you go over to the wireless support chat area. And you click on that and start up a technical support chat. And then once the representative comes online, you tell them, hey, I want to unlock my iPhone. Here's my IMEI number. And then they will go in and verify that you're eligible, that you're off contract, and that your account's in good standing, you meet all of their requirements. And then at that point, supposedly, they will send the information off to Apple, and then Apple is supposed to contact you via email within 72 hours, although the reports I was reading said that it was happening even quicker than 72 hours, and they would send you this email. You'd get a message telling you that you need to connect your iPhone to a Mac or a PC, launch iTunes, and then run a full backup and restore of the phone. And then once it's restored, it'll be unlocked. It'll tell you it's unlocked. So that's how most of the sites I was reading was reporting the experience. In my case, I decided that I wanted to call AT&T rather than using the chat system. But other than that, it was pretty much a very similar process. I didn't expect the experience to be all that different. So I called them up. I had to punch a few buttons to get to a live agent, but they picked up relatively quickly. Within a minute or two, I was talking to someone, and she was very helpful. Although the first thing that I realized was that, at least with the first tier support, they're not all aware of what's going on, because she at first said that only iPhones purchased directly from AT&T were unlockable, or she thought that only phones that were purchased directly from AT&T were unlockable, and told me that since I had purchased mine directly from Apple, I'd have to go to Apple directly. I explained to her that I had heard a little bit different on that process, and she went and checked, and after a few minutes, she agreed to kind of take my information. She said, "We'll go ahead and we'll set up a ticket and we'll see what'll happen." But she still seemed kind of unconvinced that the process was actually going to work. But she opened up the ticket. She did explain when she was opening the ticket that it had to go to another department within AT&T, a technical department, and that they would then, I guess, I don't know, validate the eligibility or what they had to do on the technical side. But she said then they would pass the information along to Apple, and then Apple would contact me with instructions. And I thought it was interesting that in both cases, they said it was ultimately Apple that would be sending emails to customers, giving them instructions on how to complete the unlock process. I didn't think Apple had really any part of it. And you would think that if it was Apple, then Apple would be telling everybody, just come straight to us and we'll unlock your phones. It seems this convoluted process to have to go through AT&T and then over to Apple, but maybe it's all part of this verifying that your phone is eligible to be unlocked. They have to kind of tell Apple, hey, they have our blessing. You can go ahead and unlock their phone through iTunes. I don't know, but it was a consistent story across both kind of processes. The other big difference that happened to me is that after she got done taking down all my information and setting up the ticket, that only took about 15 minutes. But she said that my contact date when I could expect to hear from Apple was going to be April 18th. I was calling on the 10th, so that was going to be 8 days before I had an unlocked device, not the 72 hours that people were reporting. Now, she did say it could happen sooner, but they were being told to, you know, give me that date as in terms of my unlock date. So I sat and I waited, and sure enough, about exactly 72 hours went by, and I did get an email, although it came from an AT&T address, not an Apple address, and it did have the instructions that I was going to need to connect my phone to iTunes. I was going to need to do a restore, and then at the end of that process, it would be unlocked. And that whole thing, again, went very smoothly. I docked into iTunes, ran the restore after, you know, 15, 20 minutes, however long that process took. It popped up on my screen and said, congratulations, you know, you have an unlocked phone. I think it did say congratulations. I can't remember. I tweeted out the message that was on screen, and I believe it was congratulations, and it was inside iTunes that you saw that message. But I was happy. Now I have an unlocked phone, and the question is, what am I going to do with it? And my hope was that I could use something like an AT&T pay-as-you-go prepaid plan with the unlocked device, although I was informed by a listener that an AT&T representative had said that the iPhone wasn't eligible to work on Go plans. I don't know how they technically would prevent it, because it's my understanding with a Go plan, you just get a SIM and the plan is attached to the SIM. So I would think once it's activated and set up, I should be able to put the SIM card into my unlocked iPhone and use the phone service. The one thing about the pay-as-you-go plans is that they don't have any data, and you still have to get a data plan, I guess, from what I was reading online, if you want to be able to use data with the device. So I'm going to probably give it a try. I'm going to see if I can use an AT&T Go plan SIM with this unlocked phone. The other thing that happened this week, though, is T-Mobile did come out and say they were welcoming anybody onto their network who has an unlocked phone, that they have over 1 million customers already using unlocked devices on their network. Thing about it was, again, I looked into their plans, and it's really not that much cheaper. It looks like it's about $59.99 a month U.S. to get a T-Mobile plan. That includes 2 gigabytes of data, unlimited talk, and unlimited texting. But the thing is that T-Mobile's data coverage with the iPhone is mostly 2G coverage, as far as I understand. So it's going to be really slow, and it's not really any cheaper or any more data than I would get if I just went with a standard AT&T plan. So I guess if you're planning on unlocking your device and using it in the States, at least with the big carriers, there's not much advantage. I'm looking right now into the mobile virtual network operators, different carriers who, they don't have their own network. They use either T-Mobile or AT&T's network, but then kind of resell service through that. So you can sometimes get that stuff cheaper. They tend to be a little bit more local. I think here in San Diego, we have Cricket. Up in LA, there's a PCS Wireless. There's a couple of these different companies around there. So if anybody happens to know somebody who has a good deal, and specifically data seems to be the problem. It seems like very few people are offering any kind of affordable data coverage. And that's really where I'd like to be able to use this device, on a pay-as-you-go plan that includes data. So if anybody knows anything that is worthwhile, please send me an email, mattcast@gmail.com. I'm going to continue to look into them, and I'll share that information with you as I figure it out. But the other big advantage of unlocking your device would be more for international travel. So I never travel internationally, unfortunately, but if I ever do get over to Europe at some point, I can take my new unlocked iPhone 3GS and buy a SIM over there, and I'll be able to continue to use my device. So that is a good advantage. But I did it. It's done. I have an unlocked AT&T iPhone. Where and when I'm going to use it still remains to be seen, but stay tuned. Those of us who had original iPhones know that one of the big things that was often a request back in the old days was that the Bluetooth on the iPhone support something called A2DP that would allow you to have stereo Bluetooth headphones for listening to music with your iPhone. And so Apple eventually added that technology to the iPhone, and a lot of people were very happy about that, and it's been great. But interestingly enough, I got a question this week, and I never really thought about it too much, but there are some instances where having that A2DP on your device might actually cause a problem rather than a benefit. I got this question from Patrick.
Adam, hi. It's Patrick in Raleigh, North Carolina. I had a question for you. I have purchased a new Ford Focus, 2012 Ford Focus, and it has the sync system in it, which allows you to kind of integrate your iPhone into the head unit pretty nicely and everything. But one of my complaints that I have is because the system supports Bluetooth streaming A2DP as well as the USB and line in and everything. When I plug my phone in, sometimes the music will show on the head unit that's playing, but in all reality, it's playing over the A2DP, which is not what's activated. My question is there a way to disable A2DP on the iPhone? So that way, I can only use it when I want to use it, which honestly is not that often because I use the USB to give me the meta tags and everything. Any information about that would be great. I love your show, and I look forward to your response.
Hey, Patrick, it's a great question. And, you know, my first initial response is going to be like, no, there's no way you can do that. And then I started thinking about it a little bit more, and I thought, well, one thing you could do is just completely turn off Bluetooth, which means it couldn't, you know, it wouldn't connect through the A2DP, it wouldn't connect through Bluetooth at all. I don't know enough about the Ford to know if that's what you would be going for, if that would work for you in this instance. But if you wanted to do that, of course, you go into Settings, General, and go under Bluetooth, and then just slide the little slider to off. And then if you ever got in a situation where you did need to use Bluetooth, maybe you're playing a game or something like that, you just have to go back in and turn it back on. So not necessarily convenient, but would serve the purpose of not connecting to your car. Another option could be if you want to leave Bluetooth turned on, you could simply disable the pairing that you have set up with your head unit by finding the car, I would assume, in the list of devices. In that case, you go into the same area and you click on the little blue arrow next to the device listing for your car, and then click the Forget This Device button. And that way, the phone will no longer be paired with the head unit of your car over Bluetooth. But once again, that may not be what you're going for, because I don't know if you want to still be able to use like Bluetooth calling over the headset or the head unit, probably. And it's only the music that's giving you trouble. So I did a little more poking on this to try and figure out if there might be a way just to disable the A2DP part. I figured Jailbreak would be a way to go. There probably are some solutions surrounding that. But in my research, it turns out, believe it or not, there's an app for that. There is actually an app that will allow you to block just the A2DP. It's called A2DP Blocker. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. It did have some notes, some caveats for it. I haven't tried the app myself, so I can't vouch for it. It seemed like it had pretty good ratings. But you need to be running the app for it to work. But I guess once it's launched, it sort of runs in the background and impacts the iPod controls so that you won't have the problem that you're having. It does say that if you're running iOS 4 or 5, you have to use something called the playback queue feature that's in the app, but it looks like it's just a little toggle switch. But if you're using that, A2DP will block the A2DP technologies, at least related to music, on your device when it's running. So you can try that app out. If anybody has used this app and knows if it works or not for Patrick's situation, it sounds like the guy who developed it built it specifically for what you're talking about, Patrick. So give that a shot. Let me know if it works. And if not, you can just simply disable Bluetooth if that's a solution for you at all. With MobileMe transitioning to iCloud soon, I'm starting to get a lot more questions surrounding iCloud syncing and iCloud features, what have you. And this week I got an email from Derek. He and his wife have been actually sharing an address book and syncing it through iTunes. He wants the full version of the address book syncing up with his contacts. But in the case of his wife's account with this shared situation, what he's done is set up a group of just the contacts that she cares about. The only problem is that with MobileMe syncing, you have to sync the entire address book. Everything syncs. So you could just go into that group and kind of filter down to that one group when you're in the contact view on the device. But overall, everything syncs. Now, the way around that and the one that Derek is using with his wife right now is they're actually syncing directly through the USB cable. And when you do that, when you dock into iTunes, it will only, you can set it up so it'll only sync a specific group. So in on Derek's phone, I guess he's syncing the whole address book with his wife's iTunes account. They have it set up to just sync this one group of shared contacts. Derek says the problem, though, is that his wife doesn't connect the phone to the Mac as much. And, you know, now that you can do so much of your iOS configuration and app updating and stuff like that and backup without being connected, I think more and more of us aren't connecting our devices. So he was wondering, is there a way with iCloud to set it up so that they can still have a shared account and then sync just a group of contacts to his wife's device? And the short answer, Derek, as far as I'm concerned, is I don't believe that you can do that. You also mentioned using Gmail syncing as a potential workaround. I don't know enough about Gmail syncing. Unfortunately, I'll have to play around with it a little bit more. You might be able to set it up through Gmail and Google syncing. If anybody is doing that sort of thing, let me know or send me an audio comment. Let us know how you're doing it. I'd be curious. But in the move to iCloud, there might be a better way to set this up and a better solution for you, Derek. Unfortunately, Derek did tell me he is currently on 10.6, and right now iCloud is not being supported by 10.6. I'm hoping that Apple is going to make a late last-minute change to allow people who are running Snow Leopard to be able to use the features of iCloud. But if you can move to iCloud, Derek, here is how I would do it. I would actually set up three iCloud accounts, one for yourself, one for your wife, and then a third, call it a family account. And you just need to have separate email addresses, which is pretty easy to do. You can get a separate Google address if you need an extra email. But go ahead and set up the three accounts. And then for the personal accounts, yours and your wife on the respective Macs and devices. So on your Mac, you're going to set up as your primary iCloud account, your iCloud account, and do the same thing on your devices, and then do the same thing with your wife's account on her Mac, set up iCloud with her iCloud account as her primary, and her devices with her iCloud account as the primary. And now here's the key. You're going to take that family account, and you're going to add that family account as an extra account on each device in each Mac. And the iCloud settings allow you to do this. You actually do it through the mail contacts and calendars settings. You just add an additional account in each of those areas. So on iOS, you go into mail contacts and calendars, you click add account, you select iCloud, and then put in the information for your family iCloud account. In macOS 10 Lion, you go into the system preferences under mail contacts and calendars and add the account and select iCloud. And you'll notice you have a few fewer settings in terms of the services that you can enable. You can really only enable mail and notes, contacts, and calendars. So you can share all those things through your family account. It sounds like in this case, you're just going to want to do the contacts. So go ahead and turn that on the shared account. And now what you can do is you can take that group of shared contacts that you've had and just move that in. When you launch address book, you'll see the family account as a category, as a section in the list there. Just go ahead and drag all of the shared contacts into that area, or just grab the whole group and put it into that shared account. And this will actually duplicate those contacts over to that new iCloud account. And so once you've confirmed that they've been moved, if you don't want to have duplicates in your contact book or contacts, you can go ahead and delete that. I would actually recommend, before doing all of this as a safety precaution, backup, do a full backup of your contacts, and then you know you'll be safe. But I did this with my own accounts, and once it was moved over, you can go ahead and delete any of those shared contacts so you don't have those duplicates. And then the calendar and address book contact apps will now have those in the list. And selecting all contacts at the top is going to show you everything from all of the accounts that are registered on that Mac or device. So they'll just appear in the contact list as if they were all in that one area. If you want to view the separate ones that are in the family account, you can drill down and just look at that list or look at your personal list of contacts. And then your wife and yourself will have those shared contacts across every account and every device. And the great news about that is when your wife updates it on her iPhone, it'll get updated on your Mac. Or if you update one on your iPhone, it'll get updated on her iPhone. So it'll all stay in sync through the iCloud service. You know, just remember that each Mac and each device needs to be connected to that shared family account and that they will have full access to view and edit those records. There's not the kind of situation where we had with Mobile Me accounts where you can share a read-only version of those contacts. Once you set this separate account up, it is full read-write access. So be aware of that, but otherwise, I think that's going to accomplish what you want it to do. Unfortunately, I know you're not running Lion yet. Maybe this will be an impetus to upgrade, and if you technically can't upgrade, I just have this gut feeling that Apple is going to have to enable or push an update for Snow Leopard to allow people to use iCloud on Snow Leopard. Holding it out to be a must upgrade to Lion when a lot of people can't is just a really bad move on Apple's part. And I think they're going to get a lot of bad press if we reach June 30th and they haven't done something to enable iCloud for Snow Leopard users. But it could happen. I really hope it doesn't. But hopefully that helps you out or maybe gives you some ideas. And hopefully one of you knows how to set this up on Google and can share that information with us. And then finally today, I have a question from Samuel, who has a new iPhone 4S and has been taking videos with that device. He also owns an original iPad and noticed that the videos that he's taken with the iPhone 4S and synced over to his Mac aren't able to be synced back to his original iPad and was wondering why. And I think it's a great question. It's a valid question for a lot of us. We get a new device. It shoots video H.264. You'd think it'd be a seamless process for Apple to allow that to sync back to our older devices. But unfortunately, it's not that easy. The issue, Samuel, is that the iPhone 4S video and the camera on that is at a higher resolution and a slightly different data format than what can be played back on the iPad 1. The maximum data rate and resolution just won't work, and there's just some differences in the H.264 encoding. So technically what that means is that on the iPad 1, you support H.264 video up to 720p, at 30 frames per second, and the encoder, the H.264 encoder, uses something called main profile level 3.1. On the iPhone 4, what you're actually shooting is H.264 video, but it's at 1080p resolution, so much higher than is supported on the iPad 1, still at 30 frames per second, but then also the encoder uses something called high profile level 4.1. So you have main profile level 3.1 on the iPad 1, you have high profile level 4.1 on the iPhone 4S. And that is where the issue comes into play. So the original iPad cannot play back that video, even though the technically the same format, H.264, is supported. So that's the why. What you can do about it is you're going to just have to make your videos shot on your iPhone 4S compatible with the older iPad. And unfortunately, that means you're going to have to convert them, potentially resulting in two different versions. If you want to maintain that original high-quality 1080p version, you'll have that, and then you'll have a different version for the original iPad. And I think the best tool for doing that is Handbrake, free application. You can download it. I'll have a link in the show notes at maccast.com. And what's nice about that is it does have a preset in it. You can use the iPad or the Apple TV 2 preset. They're actually technically the same in terms of what's going on under the hood. But you just set that preset, drop your iPhone 4S videos into that, allow them to convert, and then put those converted videos back into iTunes and then sync them back to your original iPad. iTunes itself also has a converter. I wasn't able to verify 100% that its converter would make your iPhone 4S videos compatible with the iPad 1 because its setting is under advanced. If you go into iTunes, go under the advanced menu, when you have a video selected, one of those iPhone 4S videos, you'll notice there's an option that'll say create iPad or Apple TV version, but it doesn't specify, and I couldn't find any details on exactly the settings that it would use. So you could try converting it in iTunes and see if that will then allow you to sync them back over to your original iPad, but that may or may not work. I would just go with the Handbrake route. I think it works well. It's a great tool, and I know those videos will be able to be synced back to your original iPad. So I hope that helps tell you why and maybe helps you solve the problem of getting those videos on your iPad. And with that, that's going to do it for this week. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors. Phoronix, makers of Deep Freeze. You can check out their software. Get more information and details over at Phoronix.com. Circus Ponies, be sure to check out Notebook. Get free trials and more information and details over at circusponies.com. Smile, they make Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label, Text Expander Touch, PDF Pen for the iPad. Great applications, great software. You can get more information and details as well as trials over at smilesoftware.com. Gazelle, get cash for your old Apple products, that iPhone, that iPad. You can get some cash back. Just do a simple search and get an offer over at gazelle.com. And VMware Fusion. You know, if you have to run Windows on your Mac, it might as well be easy and seamless. So check it out. You can get 10% off your order if you use the code MACCAST, and get more information and details at vmware.com/Mac. Big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the show. A big thank you to you for your support. Thanks for listening. Thanks for staying subscribed. Also, thank you for sending in your comments and your questions. I always like receiving those. If you have a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, or just something to say, maybe a review, or you want to chime in on one of the topics we talked about today, you can send your email to maccast@gmail.com, or you can call in on the listener hotline. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. You can leave voicemail there. And I'm also on Skype, so if you'd like to save on long-distance charges, you can leave voicemail on Skype. The Skype address is TheMacCast. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about in this or any other episode of The MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. If you'd like to follow me online, I can be found on Twitter, twitter.com/maccast, or over on the maccast.com Facebook page. That's at facebook.com/themaccast. And until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.